Okay, good evening, everyone. It is wonderful to see you. It's nice to know we have so many people in our community who have such healthy marriages and only want to make them stronger. So it's good to see everybody. We have pens and pens up here in case you want to take notes for your neighbor. Not for you, but for your neighbor. Feel free to come up. We brought some pads and paper. We're going to go through a PowerPoint tonight. I have copies of the PowerPoint. So afterwards, feel free to take them. I didn't want to give them out in advance, or else you might be distracted and read them, but you can take it with you afterwards. I'm really, really excited to share this with you tonight, because a few years ago, when I had the privilege of spending 2 days at a training session that was organized by Nefesh, the Organization of Orthodox Mental Health Professionals, in collaboration with Yeshiva University, and I got to hear Dr. Gottman for 2 days, his insights and his lessons were so powerful, were so poignant, that instantly they improved my life. Not only my marriage, which thank God was amazingly strong but became even stronger, but other relationships in my life as well. And as I sat there that day listening to him, as I understood his insights, it became so clear how steeped his thinking is in Chazal, how much his teachings are based on our timeless Torah and its values. And so what we're going to see tonight, in the first part of our four-part series, we'll see how far we get, and then we'll just pick it up simply next week, is this unique Gottman method, which has been embraced around the world, together combined with some of our timeless Torah teaching. So let's start by talking about what Shalom Bayis is not. And I already apologize, some of you may have heard some of this we've done in the past, so if it's chazara, if it's repetition, that's always good for everybody, but there's a lot of new stuff as well. What is Shalom Bayis not? So the wrong definition of Shalom Bayis. Too many men think, you know what Shalom Bayis is? Shalom bias. They stay out of the house. The more they're away, the greater peace they think there's going to be. And too many women think, what is the definition of shalom bias? If you want shalom, buy it. That, of course, is the wrong definition. If a person has to be avoiding others, if they have to avoid their wife and children or their husband and children in order to achieve peace and serenity, that is an indication there's something wrong. If a person needs to numb themselves to the reality of their married life by shopping or by purchasing things, if they have to numb themselves, that's also not right. So what is the definition of shalom bayis? So before we begin, I want to give the following disclaimers. Not that any of you were confused and thought I was, but lest anyone go home tonight and say, who is Goldberg? He doesn't have a PhD, he's not a therapist, he's not a psychologist, psychiatrist. I know, you're not telling me anything I didn't know already. I am not an expert, I'm not a trained therapist, but I have counseled dozens of couples in a supplemental, complementary role, always referring to a trained therapist, but nevertheless still continuing to try at least to play a role and have experience in that capacity. So this presentation represents insights from 2 days I mentioned earlier that I attended with Dr. John and Julie Gottman, combined with informal but somewhat extensive personal experience in this large community. In Boca, 1 month is 10 years, so 10 years is a lifetime of dealing with these issues. Who is Dr. John Gottman? Why am I sharing with you his teachings? And why do I so highly recommend his book as the answer, the authoritative approach to having a healthy marriage? He's world-renowned for his work on marital stability and divorce prediction. He's conducted 40 years of breakthrough research with thousands of couples. His work on marriage and parenting has earned him numerous major awards. This all comes actually from his website. You can look at his Wikipedia page, or if you simply Google John Gottman, go to news, you'll see every day there are hundreds of articles that are drawn from his insights. He's won 4 National Institute of Mental Health Research Science Award, the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapists Distinguished Research Sciences Award, and you could read it on your own, but many, many awards. He's also the author of 190 published academic articles, and the author or co-author of 40 books, including several bestsellers. He knows what he's talking about when it comes to marriage. But here's what is unique, and here are a few of his books that I highly recommend. You'll notice the kippah on his head. He happens to be a traditional Jew, which I believe has influenced his thinking on these issues, and he's proud, and it's something we can be proud of as well. Here's where he comes from, and here's why I share his teachings with you. Most times you read marriage books, most times you read insights or you listen to lectures and seminars from so-called marriage experts. They focused almost exclusively on failed marriages. Where did it go wrong? Why does it fall apart? where are the indications of something unhealthy? What Dr. John Gottman did is categorically different. Of course, he identified and saw the challenges in marriage, but he didn't focus on where it goes wrong, where there's dysfunction, and when it falls apart. He tried to study what are the building blocks, what are the foundations of a healthy marriage, rather than what will destroy marriage, what are necessary prerequisites, what are absolute categorical things that need to be part, the ingredients that make up a healthy marriage. And he did this through a longitudinal study of 677 couples for 15 years in a very unusual way. He would counsel them, he would interact with them, he would interview them, but he would also videotape them interacting with one another. Now you'll say, who acts normally when you're videotaped? In that seminar, he shared with us some of those videos when he was trying to give examples. And the truth is, when you know you're videotaped, when you know you're monitored, so at first I'm sure you're very cognizant, you're very aware, you may act differently. But after time, the video, the camera becomes in the background and you become acting your normal self. And he watched people and he tried to identify and extract what are the behaviors that become the predictors of divorce and what are the behaviors that, as I said, are the building blocks and the necessary criteria of a healthy marriage. Through his interviews and his observations, studied healthy and thriving marriages, not just ones that are failing ones. He identified indicators of successful marriages and those that are failing, and this is what all the articles reference when they talk about him, it's been proven time and time again, he can predict by sitting and observing a couple. He can predict with a greater than 90% accuracy rate whether they will be divorced in 4 years. Does he have a crystal ball? Is he guessing? Is he a Navi, a prophet? No. He has just created, through his expertise, he has identified what are the indicators, the criteria, that will predict a divorce and those that are necessary for a healthy marriage. We'll share some of them tonight, and you'll see it doesn't take rocket science. If you see these behaviors, if you see these attitudes among a couple, you can know that that marriage is in trouble. If they're not present and you see the healthy behaviors, then you know that you have a healthy marriage in front of you. Okay, conflict in marriage. Should an ideal marriage have no conflict? I'm not going to ask any questions tonight. People should feel free to share, write down a question, or raise your hand if you want to interact, but I'm not going to put anyone on the spot. Should an ideal marriage have conflict? What?
It should have conflict.
You say yes. Anyone say no? Many people live life ambitious and aspiring for a marriage that has no conflict. The ideal marriage is one of bliss, is one of peace and tranquility, is one where the couple is entirely aligned. They agree on everything. They share the same dreams, aspirations, and tastes. They have the same interests and hobbies. They have the same reaction and response. They want to do the same thing all the time. The perfect marriage is the one that is free of any conflict. And that is an absolute misnomer and misconception. Research revealed then 69% of conflict in relationships is perpetual and by definition has no resolution. Let me say that another way. Two-thirds of the fights that you're going to have in your marriage, two-thirds of the fight that you have are repeating the same thing, are fighting about the same things over and over, and fighting about things that have no resolution, that have no solution, that have no easy answer. What are the things that people fight about in marriage? So every study shows, in some formulation of this order, the top things people fight about in marriage are money, in-laws, and intimacy. Money, spending habits, saving habits, attitude towards money. In-laws are family relationships, how we conduct ourselves, how we interact with one another's family, and intimacy, frequency of intimacy, interest in intimacy, and every issue that arises surrounding the area of intimacy. There are obviously many other things that people can fight about, but almost all marriages at some point find conflict in these three areas. This statistic is astounding. Almost 70% of conflicts are perpetual ones. And if you look back at your married life, no matter how long you've been married, you probably recognize that to one degree or another, you've been fighting about the same fight. You've been having the same fight over and over and over again around money, visiting family, or areas of intimacy, or other areas of life. It could be whether you're going out to eat meat or dairy. It could be about who you're having over or whether you like to host guests. It could be, but wherever the differences are, they arise over and over and over again. And those differences usually do not have a simple or obvious resolution. So is that a sign of an unhealthy marriage? If 70% of your fights are perpetual ones, if you're arguing about the same things over and over and over again, is that a marriage which is in trouble? Remember, we described before that at least in our own mind and fantasy land, the ideal marriage is bliss. Perfectly aligned, getting along, same interests, never disagreeing, wanting the same things, having the same likes. If you fight ever, if there's any conflict or difference of opinion, and certainly if 70% of the arguments are the same over and over and over, and what usually happens, each side is exasperated. I cannot believe you have not yet come to see it my way. What is the matter with you? How many times do I have to explain this? How wrong could you possibly be? For 30 years I've been telling you this. And we just revisit the same fight with the same language, with the same escalation, with the same dissolving, with the same no talking for 3 days, with the same groveling afterwards, with the same over and over and over and over again. We're not very creative. Only 30% of our fights are new ones. 70% of them are the same fight over and over. So is that a sign of an unhealthy marriage? And the answer that Gottman says is absolutely not. Not only is it not the sign of an unhealthy marriage, but conflict, the presence of differences of opinion, is something which is very, very healthy. Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz was once visiting our community. And before the program began, when he was going to be speaking, he was making himself a cup of coffee. And it was in someone's home, and there was a little coffee area set up. And I'll never forget, because of the way he shared this brilliant insight so nonchalantly. You know, he asked me, if you've ever interacted with Rabbi Steinsaltz, brilliant, brilliant man, but very direct, very to the point. He said to me, "Rabbi, what's special about your community? How would you describe your community? What makes your community special?" So that's like music to my ears, right? I love that question. Well, I start to break into a whole Shabbos with Russia. Our community values diversity but celebrates unity. So Rabbi Steinsaltz is like mixing his coffee, and he looks up at me and he says, "Of course, if you value unity, you have diversity. If you don't have diversity, you don't have unity, you have uniformity." That's what he said to me, while mixing, stirring a cup of coffee. If you don't have diversity, you can't have unity. You can only have unity with diversity. Without diversity, you wouldn't have unity, you would have uniformity. He didn't reference this. This is a medrash, it's also a gemara. Vaydaber Moshe l'Hashem yekor Hashem, halacha. The following is a tosefta in brachos, and a medrash as well. Imra harbe ochlosen shel bnei adam. If you are present at a massive rally, an enormous gathering, and you see a myriad of Jews, you recite a bracha. This is actually a blessing, seeing so many Jews in one place. What's the bracha? It doesn't say Jews, actually it says shel bnei adam, of human beings. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu melech olam, chacham harazim. God is the wise person of secrets, Keshem She'in Partzufo Seyam Domem Zela Zeh, just as no two people's faces are exactly alike, Kach Ein Daitan Shavim Zela Zeh, Elokol Echad Ve'echad Yesh Lo Deya Bifnei Atmo. Just like no two people have the exact same DNA, no two people look exactly alike, similarly, no two people think exactly alike. We come from different perspectives and different attitudes. We have different approaches. We have different baggage. We have different backgrounds. We have different experiences and different emotions that take us in different directions. What's the kishem? Kishem. Just like no two people look exactly alike, so too no people think exactly alike. And let me ask you, is that a source of sadness? Is that something that we accept but we wish everyone was the same? No, we make a bracha. We celebrate those differences. We appreciate and we welcome that people come from different perspectives. What does it mean, kishem, just like? I once heard a magnificent explanation. You would never begrudge another person for looking different than you. I don't like that your hair is a different color than mine. I can't be friends with you. Your eyes are a different color than mine. You're a different height. We can't hang out. Your facial features are different than mine. You would never begrudge someone for looking different. So how could you begrudge someone for thinking differently? Because just like we are programmed to look different, so too we are programmed, both nature and as well nurture, our experiences, make us different. And those differences, we are to celebrate, we are to embrace, we are to applaud. Kol echad ve'echad yesh lo dea b'fnei atzmo. God designed the world to be diverse, not to be exactly the same. This world would be a boring place. Relationships would have no meaning if there were uniformity to life. If everyone looked alike, acted alike, thought alike, voted alike, rooted alike, cheered alike, and had the same taste, it would be a boring world. What makes the world dynamic and interesting and rich, what makes relationships meaningful, is that there are differences that need to be navigated. There are debates, there are conversations, there are negotiations. Just very quickly, this is the Nitziv's insight on Migdal Bavel. We just read about it last week. The people who built the Tower of Bavel wanted to achieve a name, Nasa Lenu Shem. They built a tower that reached to the heavens. But what did they do that was so bad? What was their egregious mistake? What was their sin that God needed to destroy the tower, disperse them among the world, and give them different languages? Says the Netziv of Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin in the 19th century, you know what their problem was? They tried to create one central authority. They wanted everyone to answer to the tower. You had to talk alike, look alike, think alike, act alike. And if you deviated from what was the normative practice, you were to be killed. It was a capital crime to be an individual. God said, that's not my world. I want my world to sparkle. I want my world to be woven from different fabrics. I want my world to be a place of unity, not uniformity. And how does he achieve it, says the Netziv? By dispersing the people across the land and giving them different languages, by introducing the very diversity that he wanted to begin with. Rav Hirsch has a magnificent insight. After this flood, and God provides the sign, the symbol that he'll never do it again. The sign is, of course, the rainbow. Writes Rav Hirsch, what is the meaning of the rainbow? By the sight of the colors of the rainbow, our attention would repeatedly be directed to the fact that in spite of all the differences in the degree of human development, God would never again decree the downfall of the whole human race, but that its future education to its godly purpose was to be founded just on these differences and varieties of humanity. For is the rainbow anything else but the one pure ray of light broken up into 7 degrees of 7 colors? And from the one to the other, are they not all rays of light? And combined all together, do they not form one complete pure white ray? For the Rav Hirsch, the rainbow, the display of colors, represents the differences in the diversity of the human people. The answer to the generation of the flood was not to try to squelch or to suppress the diversity, but to welcome it, to celebrate it, to promote it, to be able to have the idea of the rainbow, the one ray of light of God expressing itself through all the brilliant colors. So conflict is very healthy. Diversity, and if you have diversity, you're going to have conflict. That word conflict has negative connotations to us, but it doesn't have to. Conflict doesn't necessarily mean the escalation of a fight or a disagreement. Conflict means you think this way and I think that way. You think we should do this, and I'd like you to consider that we do that. You enjoy or have tastes for this music or this food or this genre of novels or this TV series, and I like something different. Conflict means we're going to approach things differently, and that's not a concession. That is the way the world was designed, because that gives meaning. It gives color. It gives meaning and purpose to the world. If there's no diversity and never conflict of opinion and perspective, it is likely, and this is not from Gottman, this is my own personal experience, if the couple that seem to be perfect, always agree, perfect tranquility and peace, everything is always right, often, if not always, one of the parties is suppressing their individuality. They're living in fear of articulating their perspective, of having their needs met, of communicating their wants. If there seems to be too perfect, everything is too okay, sometimes that is the greatest indication that there's something wrong. Somebody is bottling up their feelings or living with fear of the consequences of disagreeing. So tension in a relationship That tension is the very catalyst for what makes a relationship incredible. I'm sure you've had the experience of having a difference of opinion, of having conflict, and when it's worked out, the relationship is healthier than it ever was. The ability to respect somebody else's perspective or opinion, the experience, the exercise of compromising and sacrificing and saying it doesn't always have to be my way, yields a healthier relationship than ever. It is the very presence of tension and conflict which sometimes is the springboard to discovering things about the other person, to growing, to advancing, to progressing, to maturing the relationship, and to each person in the relationship becoming better. Just a few more examples of this. Marriage as a whole, in Jewish philosophy and Torah sources, marriage as a whole is a platform for personal growth in this area. Not about making the other fit into the mold of who you are. You don't want to marry yourself. You wouldn't have much of a marriage if you married yourself. You know, we like to think we would. What was that movie? It was called Stepford Wives. You programmed the robot and they did exactly what you wanted. Right? In theory, then we can make all the marriage jokes in the world. Wouldn't it be great if we could be programmed to agree with us, do what we want, speak to us when we want, be quiet when we weren't interested, do everything we wanted? It would be fantastic, right? It'd be boring. It would lack meaning. There'd be no love. There'd be no romance. There'd be no personal growth. You wouldn't be alive. That relationship is not even a life support. The relationship is altogether dead. What gives dynamism to a relationship is the tension. Are the different opinions? Is the very diversity? So the fact that your spouse likes different things than you, or thinks differently than you, or communicates differently than you, or has different habits than you, is not something that you should be seeking to change. Of course, in a relationship, we're always trying to improve one another. But the fact that we're different is not something we're trying to erase or transform. You need to fit into my mold. Why am I marrying you? Because I have a life mission to make you more like me. That is the sign of a very unhealthy relationship. Diversity and tension and conflict in a relationship is not only healthy, it is a foundation of relationships. The Gemara in Sota says, Kasha lezavgan kakriyas yamsif. Anyone here is in the world of shiduchim, you've tried to set people up, you yourself are dating, or you remember the experience of dating. The Talmud says something that is astounding. The Talmud says, it is as difficult to have a healthy marriage as it was for God to split the sea. To enjoy and experience a healthy, functional marriage is as supernatural, as miraculous, as noteworthy and newsworthy as the splitting of the sea. And the Maharal, Rabbi Yehuda Lowy of Prague, wonders why. Of all the metaphors he could have drawn, of all the examples, why the splitting of the sea? Why not say as difficult as the creation of the world, or as difficult as making a donkey speak, or the earth opens? Why the splitting of the sea? The Maharal here in this section has a brilliant insight. He says, water by definition is one. Water molecules stick together. If you have a bowl of water and I hand you a fork and knife, can you cut the water in two? Of course not, it's ridiculous. The water always flows to be together. Water is naturally one. When God intervened and divided it into two, He suspended the rules of nature. He transcended nature. It was a miracle. It was a miracle to make water into two. Says the Maharal, human beings are exactly the opposite. We are by our natures separate and apart and different. We have self-interests. We are interested in our needs, our happiness, our wants, our tastes, what we want to do, where we want to eat, when we want to talk, what we want to watch. We have self-interests. To take two people and make them one is no less miraculous than taking the one and making it two. A healthy marriage, and the statistics today bear this out, long after the Gemara and the Maharal, the divorce statistics in the world, the infidelity statistic, the dysfunctional statistics of the world, tell us that indeed to be in a healthy marriage is nothing short of supernatural. It's miraculous. When two people can blend their lives together, when two people can integrate, can complement one another, can figure out the give and take, the yin and yang of when is what you want more important, or on this one I think we need to do it my way, how should we navigate our differences, and how should we negotiate our diversity, that is nothing short of miraculous. resolution. Question is, how is the perpetual conflict navigated? So the first thing we talked about, Gottman, again, I'm not going to keep repeating his name, but know that all of this is based on his teaching. First thing we said is, conflict is not to be squelched or erased or removed. We don't aspire in a relationship to never disagree again. That would be boring and dull, and the relationship would be dead. So how do you resolve conflict? If 2/3 or more of all conflicts are perpetual ones, if we're fighting about the same things, oh, you keep leaving your dirty dishes in the sink, why can't you put your socks in the hamper? How many times do I ask you to pick up my dry cleaning? Or that I don't like that brand? We talk about the same things, we fight about them over and over and over again. So how are they resolved? So this is Gottman's incredible insight. It's the most basic, fundamental, simple thing in the world. You're going to say, really? Best-selling books for this? And yet, when you hear his formulation, you'll realize it changes your life. Couples can either identify the fundamental differences and successfully dialogue and navigate them, or they can live in a perpetual state of gridlock and revisit the conflicts over and over and over and over again. When we stand under that chuppah, we intend on being married for the rest of our lives. That's our intention. So please God, we will celebrate 40 or 50 or 60 years of marriage, and with life expectancy expanding, we might even be stuck together for longer and longer and longer. The sooner in our marriage that we identify where we look at things differently, and rather than have gridlock, and in the moment when the tempers are rising, when the blood pressure is rising, when the fireworks are shooting, rather than in that moment, but the sooner in a relationship that we recognize, you know what, we see things differently. I have an idea. Why don't we talk about that? Why don't we navigate that? Why don't we come up with a strategy and plan about what we will do when those things come up? What should we do? At the seminar I took with Gottman, he actually showed us a video. He had been counseling a couple, and in front of, on the video, the couple is fighting and fighting and fighting, and one of their areas of gridlock, the perpetual fighting, 2/3 of their marriage, 2/3 of their fights, is money. He came from a very wealthy home that spent very freely. Right? The kind of guy that buys a water and snacks at the airport, despite the prices. She came from a poorer background, less privileged. Every penny was saved and counted and mattered. So if you were thirsty in the airport, you drank at the water fountain, and don't worry, they'll give you a drink on the plane, but there's no way you're paying that for a water bottle. And they were constantly fighting about that kind of thing. Do you buy water in the airport? You know, should we spend on this? What kind of vacation? How often do we go out to eat? Are you buying, shopping, and so on? Gridlock, fighting, fighting, fighting. Are you crazy? You're spending again? What's the matter with you? How come you never let me spend? I work hard. Don't I deserve? Fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting and stuff. So on the video, Gottman shows, he goes into a classroom of kids. And he says, I don't remember the age, it's young kids. And he says, boys and girls, I need your help today. I have friends, and they're arguing a lot. Because he came from a rich background, he likes to spend money, she came from a poor background, and she wants to be more frugal. What do you think they should do? This little girl raises her hand. She says, I think they should sometimes spend money and sometimes not spend money. What was Gottman's point? Of course that's the answer. Of course, in a state of calm, the couple needs to say, we come from different backgrounds and different expectations and different perspectives on money. We can either fight about it for the rest of our lives, or we can decide, when it comes to this area, let's be a little looser with money. When it comes to this area, let's be more frugal. How do we reach decisions? Please don't spend money without our agreeing on it. Any amount over that. How do you come up with rules or principles or agreed upon habits, practices, so that instead of fighting over and over and over again, you are anticipating those fights and resolving them before they ever occur, simply by having identified the differences and having a conversation about it. Ever since I came back from the Gottman seminar, I shared this with every couple I've interacted with who've come to meet with me over issues of conflict. It sounds so obvious, right? After the fact. It sounds so basic after the fact. But there are couples who've been married 10 years, or 30 years, or 45 years, who've never actually considered, maybe we should talk about the differences that keep leading to the same perpetual fights, instead of just having them over and over again. Right? Some couples are so good at these fights, they actually spare themselves having the fight. You're going to say this, I'm going to say this, let's just skip it and not talk to each other for 3 days. Because they know the pattern of that fight. You fight over the same things over and over and over again. So there was once a case of a couple whose marriage was failing so miserably that one of the parties had literally already filed for divorce. The marriage was on its last legs. They fought and fought and fought. They had grown apart. They grew so far apart. And they led such different lives. And they saw no way they could possibly be together, one party even more than the other. And I just come back from the Gottman seminar, and I met with them. And I said, before you follow through on this, can I make the following suggestion? I have a homework assignment for each of you. And this is a homework assignment for you tonight. Not now with the pad and paper, but at some point in the near future. Separately than your spouse, come up with a list, not of where they're so wrong and the things they need to change and how bad they are. That's not the list. Come up with a list, identify the areas that you think you find yourselves fighting over and over. Are one of you more of a knee freak and the other more of a slob? And so you keep fighting about, you know, the dishes. It's unreasonable that the house looks a mess. But it's also unreasonable that one fork can't sit in the sink for one night. Clearly that can be navigated. But usually instead of negotiating it, you just fight over the fork or the mess. What are the areas? Each party write down what are the areas. Not a list of 30 things. 3 things. The top 3 things in your marriage that you think are the recurring perpetual fights that come up over and over. And then go out on a date. Starbucks, find a park bench, go out for a meal. A public space to have this conversation. And why a public space? It's my recommendation, not Gottman. Hopefully, the public space will prevent voices from rising, finger pointing from flying, expletives from bombs bursting in air. Being in a public space, hopefully, will be the deterrent, the babysitting that we need. And then you compare lists. My prediction, the great likelihood is, the lists will align very well. You also have a lot in common if you got married. And you're not stupid, and you know the things that you tend to fight about over and over again. So you compare lists. And that's that date. Compare lists. Oh, it's interesting, we had the same things. Oh, it's interesting, you put that, I didn't, but you're right, we do fight. Or you put that and I didn't. I don't think we fight a lot about it. And then you'll have a whole fight about whether you fight about that thing. But then you could just put that on the list. But, and then you make a date. Then you get together again. For each of the items on the gridlock perpetual fight list, and you tackle them one by one. Does it mean that you're going to perfect it? Does it mean you're going to eliminate it? Absolutely not. There's still diversity. People are still different. There still are tempers that flare and emotions that run high. But imagine if you can say, look, we've been fighting about this for the last 10 years, and I'm tired. And I concede. I'm not going to convince you. And you're not going to convince me. I won't turn you into a slob, and you won't turn me into a need freak. I'm not going to make you on time, and you're not going to make me late. I'm not going to make you spendthrift, and you're not going to make me frugal. I'm not going to make you this. At some point, you have to concede the fight's not going to be resolved. And once both parties are willing to concede, now you can go through the important work of saying, now what? So how should we deal with it? If I'm a slob and you're a neat freak, where can we find the middle ground? What's reasonable? It's unreasonable for my dirty laundry to be next to the hamper. You got that close. You couldn't bother putting it in. You're just there. Would it be too much trouble? It's reasonable not to be a slob. It's unreasonable to hold the entire family and house to the standard of OCD. That's unfair. So let's have a discussion. How can we discuss and navigate? This is Gottman's brilliant line. I underline and bold it. If you take nothing else away from tonight, it's this. In every conflict, there was a conversation that needed to happen, but the fight occurred instead. In every conflict, there was a conversation that needed to happen, but the fight occurred instead. So let's create the opportunity for the conversation. You never resolve things when tempers are flaring. Chazal already said that. Don't try to appease somebody, b'shas kaso. In the moment of rage, one's literally, anatomically, your blood pressure goes up, your sweat glands are producing, your endorphins are releasing, your adrenaline is rushing. You become somebody who's not human. So you can't have a conversation, you can't talk rationally, you can't resolve conflict in the moment of conflict. So better to do it when there is no conflict. Identify the things about which there's conflict and go out and discuss it and talk about it. So that's your homework for tonight. For each side, to try to list the things that you find yourselves constantly disagreeing about, at best, fighting about, at worst. Hopefully the list aligns. If they don't, that'll be fascinating and very instructive in its own right. And if they do, you have numerous meetings and conversations. Marriage takes work. Marriage is no less complicated than being a doctor, a lawyer, or being a rabbi for which you go to school. Maybe you took Chassan and Kala classes, maybe, but nobody here went to school for marriage. It takes work. It takes effort. It doesn't change or improve on its own. It takes these kinds of exercises and thought, which I have to tell you are exhilarating. When you've identified that area, could you imagine, understand the result of this? In every conflict, there was a conversation that needed to happen, but the fight occurred instead. So you now, let's say over the next month, you identify, you know, you each made your list, you've thought about it, you sat on it, it wasn't just impulsive. Then you had your date, you compared them, and you combined them, and you identified the three areas that you perpetually are in gridlock that you tend to argue over and over. And then you start, and you have a series of meetings to try to negotiate, navigate, how can we come to an agreement about what to do? Where's a good, reasonable middle ground? And what will be the result of all that? Well, if 70% of our fights are the perpetual ones, you could resolve two-thirds of your fights. You could eliminate two-thirds of the fighting in your marriage by following this course of action. Resolution. I told you the story. The key is to both be prepared to give in the relationship and to know when it is time to stand ground and when to give in. You see, in that conversation, in that negotiation, I'm the slob, you're the neat freak, I'm the spendthrift, you're the frugal, I'm the this, you're the that. Well, if both stand their ground and are unwilling to be flexible, then you're just going to keep revisiting those fights. Have fun. Keep fighting away for the next 100 years. Both parties have to be willing to be flexible, to compromise, to give in, to meet halfway, to navigate and negotiate. In love and marriage, you say, if that means so much to you, then I'll get my socks in the hamper. If that means so much to you, then I will be more flexible of there being a dish in the sink over. I'm giving all silly examples because divorces don't happen over major theoretical, philosophical, ontological, theological. Divorces happen over the cap on the toothpaste and the toilet seat and the socks next to the hamper and the little things that make a person feel they don't matter. That what they care about doesn't matter. That they're not a priority. So both parties need to be prepared to give. Rav Dessler discussed this in the past at length. Love comes from giving, not taking. Rav Dessler developed at length the principle. See, and this is the core of why marriages are failing today. Marriages are failing all around us because the parties are entering the marriages looking to receive, to get, rather than to give. Why are you getting married? Because I want to be happy. I like the companionship. I have a need. I want satisfaction. I want fulfillment. I want camaraderie. My need. What I want. And it makes sense to think that love is the result of receiving. You give me something. Oh boy, I'm going to love you. The more you give me, the more I'll love you. That sounds logical. But if Dessler proved that love is not the result of receiving, actually, the more you receive, the more selfish you get, the less you really love. You might feel gratitude, you might feel indebted, but you don't really feel love. Love is not the result of receiving. Love, counterintuitively, is the result of giving. And how does Rav Dessler prove that? Think about the following relationship. If you're blessed with children, do you love your children more or do your children love you more? I've never met a parent who said, my children love me more than I love them. Never. And the child who thinks they love their parent more than the parent loves them only thinks that till they become a parent themselves. And they learn and understand that that child could never possibly love them as much as they love their child. Says their destiny, why is that? Particularly in the early part of life, you spend all your energy, time, resources, money, giving and giving and giving. When your child is a baby, you get nothing from them. You give up your sleep, you give up your money, you give up your time, you give up your needs, you give up everything. And yet, the result is, you love them more than they could possibly ever love you. Because love is the result not of receiving, but love is the result of giving. That is the paradigm, that is the model of love. Why is that? We don't have enough time tonight, it's a whole separate topic in its own right. But because when you love something else, you're actually investing a piece of yourself in it. So you love the other thing as an extension of yourself. When you've given your time or your energy or your resources, then you've given a piece of yourself. You've invested yourself. And you love the other. And the other can even be an inanimate object. There are people who love their car or their house. And I don't mean in a superficial way only that we give drushes negatively about. But I mean they worked their tuchus off to earn every penny to buy that car. And when they sit and drive that car represents their years of toil and effort and energy. And so when you give of yourself, when you plant, invest a piece of yourself, you love the other as an extension of yourself. The Hebrew word ava, the root, the Aramaic hav, hav means to give. Love is the result, says Rav Dessler in a long essay, of giving, rather than of receiving. He writes, this is from Strive for Truth, the translation of a Sefer Michtav Melio, we must rather say this love arises between husband and wife because they complement each other. This fact flows from the nature with which the Almighty has endowed them. Alone, every person is defective and unable to carry out his proper function. Together, they complement each other. And by giving each other this completion, they come to love each other. On the principle we've already established, the one who gives loves. When two people enter a relationship, each looking to receive, you'll have a divorce. You'll have a very unhappy, dysfunctional marriage. When two people enter a relationship, each prepared, interested, and eager to give, they will each get back more than they ever gave up in the process. The experience of giving is what yields love. The willingness to say, you know what, that's how you see it, that's what you want to do, that's your taste, let's do it your way. That feels great for me. Because I know that whatever I gave up in the process, the compromise I made, the sacrifice I offered, the pleasure of feeling intimate and close and connected, of feeling genuine love, not the love like, I love that song, I love that band, I love that show, I love pizza. Not that love. We use the same word to describe our attitude to our favorite food and the person we pledge the rest of our life with, which undermines the whole word. Love doesn't even mean anything anymore. But the real, authentic, genuine love is the result of being willing to sacrifice and to give. Dysfunctional marriage. Can we spend just a couple more minutes? I said it was going to be an hour. Oh, we're not at an hour. We started at 8:15. Beautiful. Okay, maybe it was your sleepy faces that threw me off. Okay. This is, so far everything I told you was obvious to you. Okay, this is the part that's exciting. Is anger the root of unhappiness in marriage? Anger as an emotion in marriage, is that the root of unhappiness? If you see a marriage that is anger, is that the indication? Is that the predictor? Would Gottman be able to say with 91% accuracy within 4 years they're going to be divorced? Gottman says anger is not the problem, nor is conflict. Not that anger is good, we're trying to eliminate anger. The Ramban and the Rambam both agree. The Ramban in his letter to his son and the Rambam in Hilchos Deos both say anger is a categorically bad emotion. We should eliminate anger from the repertoire. Anger has no room as one of the ingredients in our recipe. How do you say character trait in Hebrew? We work on our midos. What does the word mida mean? A measure. The Orchos Tzadikim says the midos are called a measure because like a chicken soup, it has to have the right recipe. You need all the ingredients. A chicken soup that has no salt stinks. It's terrible. It's tasteless. But if you put in too much salt, it's horrible. Pepper adds good flavor. Too much pepper, you'll destroy the soup. Character traits are midos. They belong in certain measure. They are ingredients that add to life. But there's one ingredient that doesn't belong in any of our recipes, right? The Ramban and the Rambam, and that is anger. And yet with that, Gottman said, he didn't quote all the Torah, but Gottman says, anger is not the problem in marriage. Again, it's not good, it's not welcome. We should work on our anger, manage our anger. Anger is not good. But anger is not the indicator or predictor of divorce. Dysfunction in marriage, he says, comes from the presence of what he calls the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Says Gottman, there are four behaviors that if they're present in marriage, oh boy, you're in trouble. If either party is acting in this way, the marriage is in trouble. And that's what Gottman looks for. When he predicts that at a high accuracy whether there'll be divorce, I mean, Gottman would have a field day at some of the Shabbos meals, and he'd see the interactions, particularly of the host, husband and wife, and what's going on. And we were once at a Shabbos meal, and people no longer live in this community, so don't try to guess or figure it out. They moved out a long time ago. But I'll never forget, and I'm the rabbi, like people you'd think are trying to be on their best behavior at the time, maybe not. But the couple literally almost got divorced in front of us because she served the salad appetizers in a different bowl than he had anticipated them being served it. And like, dishes were flying and, you know? Okay, anyway. So, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. You can observe couples. Well, it's hardest to observe. Your own self-awareness is sometimes the hardest, but you can see this in others, right? So let's talk about your neighbors a little bit. So, the following four behaviors, they are the death. This is the worst diagnosis. This is the worst thing for a marriage. Criticism, defensiveness, contempt, and stonewalling. Let's take them one by one. Criticism. Attacking your partner's personality or character, usually with the intent of making someone right and someone wrong. So in other words, we're going to have a disagreement, but rather than make it about the issue, it's going to be an ad hominem attack. I'm going to talk about you, your deficiency, your weakness, where you stink, where you're wrong, and you know why you're like that? Because your mother's like that, and her mother's like that, and your sister's even worse than you at that. You've always been like that. You're this, that, and you're the other. Right? So when is there criticism? Generalization, says Gottman, that includes you always or you never. You're the type of person who? Why are you so cheap? Why are you such a gossiper? Why do you never think? Why are you always so selfish? That language, you always, you never, you're the person who, why are you so? It personalizes the conflict, which means you've eliminated the possibility of resolution. You've created this wall between the two of you. How would you react to being spoken to that way? Well, you know, I never really thought about it that way. I am just like my mother, and my mother's a horrible person. How would you react to that? You would never react well to that. All right, so let's come up with an example. I have no clean shirts. And I need my dry cleaning picked up. And I reminded my wife like three times, could you get the dry cleaning? Bring in the old shirt, pick up the shirts, I need my dry cleaning. And yeah, I got a big meeting tomorrow, and dry cleaner's closed now, it's too late, and she didn't pick them up again. So I come home and I say, you never pick up my dry cleaning. All you think about is yourself. Well, I bet you picked up the things you wanted. I bet you got the things you needed. How many times were you at Target today? Or were you at Costco today? Or Publix today? Or the mall today? You never. You always. I don't matter. You're so irresponsible. You don't care. That will never lead towards resolving the conflict. How could the same thing be communicated in a way which could achieve the desired result? It could be communicated, not in a personal way that includes an ad hominem attack. You are this, that, and the other. This is a reflection of a character flaw. This is a reflection, or this exposes a corruption, a virus in your software. But rather, I know you're very busy, and I know you didn't do this on purpose to hurt me. But when I needed the dry cleaning, and I tried to remind you, and you didn't pick it up, it makes me feel like I don't matter. It makes me feel like I'm not a priority. Now, can you disagree with what I'm describing, how it makes me feel? What are you going to say? It does not make you feel that way. What are you talking about? I'm telling you, it makes me feel that way. So I can't tell you how you feel, and it won't get me anywhere to call you a name or put you in a category or dismiss you or put you down or make you feel bad. But what can be productive in moving the conversation forward about dry cleaning for the future is, I know you had no malice. I know you weren't trying to do anything to hurt me. I know you like me to appear clean and put together. But when you failed to pick up the dry cleaning, even though we talked about it, I'm just letting you know it makes me feel like I'm unimportant. Like I don't matter. The other person is much more likely to respond favorably to that than they are to, you're irresponsible, your mother's irresponsible, your sister is the most irresponsible. This is based on a Gemara in Tainus. Rabbi Meir was a brilliant man. His wife was even more brilliant. Rabbi Meir's wife was Bruria. Rabbi Meir's head was in the clouds. He was a brilliant man, a scholar. And he had no tolerance for the hooligans and gangsters, for the people who lived near him. This is a Gemara in Tainus. Chav Gimel on the base. There were evil people in Rabbi Meir's neighborhood who used to bother him a lot. So what did he do? He's sitting in his study. He's trying to learn. They're making all kinds of noise, a racket outside, speaking Lashon Hara, doing all kinds of things. So what did Rabbi Meir do? He grabbed his tehillim and he davened that they die. I hope they drop dead. They are detracting from my ability to learn. I hope they die. Bruria, his brilliant wife, says to him, sweetie, honey, Rabbi Meir, dear. The verse says, we read it at the end of Baruch Nafshi every Rosh Chodesh, Yitamu chata'im min ha'aretz, not chot'im. The verse says, we ask God to remove the chata'im, the mistakes, the indiscretions, the shortcomings, the sins. We ask God to eliminate those. We don't say, Yitamu chot'im, God, destroy the evildoers. God, eliminate anyone who makes a mistake. We ask God to eliminate mistakes. So says Rav Bruria to Rav Meir, honey, don't daven that they die, daven they repent. So Rav Meir did. He changed the whole paradigm of his thinking. Instead of davening they die because they were annoying to him, he davened, they changed their ways, and they did. Depersonalize it. And when you depersonalize, you can make much more progress. You know, the great basketball coach, Phil Jackson, once wrote a book called Secret Hoops. Very interesting book. We talked about his coaching philosophy in Chicago and LA. And he's the coach of the Knicks now. Hasn't worked there. He's GM of the Knicks. I guess it hasn't worked so well there. But and one of the principles he has in his book, Sacred Hoops, I remember he teaches the idea of depersonalizing criticism. If the team has a philosophy, if the team has a strategy, if the team has a plan that is clearly articulated and agreed upon, when you don't follow the plan, and I share that with you, I'm not criticizing you. I'm simply pointing out what we all agreed to, what the plan was, what we were all supposed to do. You can have a much more productive conversation when you depersonalize the conversation. I remember thinking that a great insight is true for shul life. He recommends it in his Sacred Hoops for leadership in the corporate world. But it's true in the nonprofit world too. Right? If you come to the committee and you say, you know, your idea is terrible, we're cutting out the way you did it, we're going to find a new way of doing it, then you're going to have a whole fight. That person thinks you're power hungry, they go tell everybody that what they're trying to do, they rally their troops, it becomes a whole politics, true politics. But if you agree as a committee or a board, these are our principles, this is what matters, these are our objectives, this is what we're trying to achieve this year, and then you measure everything through that lens, then if that doesn't make sense anymore, it's not because it's you and it's me and I'm personalizing and it's power, but now we've had common ground and we're measuring everything through it, and that's one of the ways to avoid the personal conflict. So whether it's Bruria's message to Rav Meir or Lahavdil, Phil Jackson, and certainly Gottman, the first horse head of the apocalypse, horseman of the apocalypse, is criticism. That doesn't mean that you can't share your reaction. It doesn't mean criticism in the sense that you can't give feedback. You can give feedback. But Gottman is defining criticism not as feedback, but as generalizations. Ad hominem attacks. You this, that, and the other. You're lazy, you're character flaw, you're nothing. And that is not going to lead to resolution. That is a predictor of a failing marriage. Number two, contempt. What a great picture of contempt. Contempt. What is contempt? Attacking your partner's sense of self with the intent to insult. Insults and name-calling. Jerk, idiot, wimp, fat, stupid, ugly, slob, lazy. hostile humor, or what I see is, I think, the greatest expression of contempt, which is sarcasm. Sarcasm is a person putting up a force field because they can't find the words to have a mature conversation. They're sarcastic. Right? Young people today would call it being snarky. That sarcasm is contempt. Body language, a face, a gesture, a tone of voice, sneering, rolling your eyes, curling your upper lip. When you have contempt, you are dehumanizing the other person. You're taking away their right to be on your level. You're essentially establishing a hierarchy. I'm up here and you're down there. I don't have a use for you. I don't have patience for you. What you have to say isn't important. I'm better. If there's contempt, sarcasm, you know where you see this sometimes? When one spouse is willing to make a joke at the other spouse's expense because getting the cheap laugh from the friends is more important than how the spouse will feel. At the Shabbos table, in front of guests. Oh, you left the thing out again, or oh, I tasted this again, or whatever it is. You won't believe what my wife did this week. Or to get the quick laugh at the expense of your spouse because it's more important to be able to gain the admiration of your friends. We're going to go home that night and you're going to stay with your spouse. That sarcasm, that humor or mockery, that body language or that tone, and certainly that name calling. The moment you're calling a name, you're a jerk. Why are you such an idiot? Fat. And the truer it is, the more accurate that you're pushing on the pressure point, the harder it is to recover from. Nobody knows how to push each other's buttons better than we do. We literally live with one another. We are in one another's most innermost worlds. We know where we are most vulnerable. And when we push that button, it is unbearably painful because we know where our spouse is weak and vulnerable. We know where it hurts the most if we talk about their appearance or their weight or their intelligence or their sophistication, or their background, or their whatever area it is of us that we take advantage of knowing, and we use that knowledge to have contempt, that is a horrific indicator. There's no room for that. Defensiveness. Seeing ourselves as the victim, warding off a perceived attack. So you make excuses. I'm not really interested, I'm not listening to what you have to say. My defense mechanism is up before you even begin. So, external circumstances beyond your control force you to act in a certain way. I didn't get your dry cleaning because your children got a cold and I had to pick them up from school. I didn't get, there was traffic and there was nothing I could do, and you lost the ticket. You didn't leave the ticket where I told you to leave the ticket last time if you wanted me to get the dry cleaning. Defensiveness means I'm not even listening, I'm not hearing, I'm not considering what you're saying. I'm not giving you the courtesy of having an opinion because I'm defensive, my shield is up. Cross-complaining, right? Which is, of course, a brilliant strategy. The best defense is a offense. I didn't pick up the dry cleaning? You didn't pick up the milk the last 10 times I asked you to pick up the milk. You never pick up what you're going to tell me about the dry cleaning? How many times have I asked you to change the bulbs? Your kids are bathing in the dark. Because you can't get to Home Depot to get bulbs, and you're going to tell me about the dry cleaning? So instead of listening to the other person and how it makes them feel, defensive, cross-complaining, you go on the offense. Disagreeing and then cross-complaining. That's not true. You're the one who. I did this because you did that. Or the phenomenon of what Gottman calls, yes, but. Starting off agreeing, but ending up disagreeing. Yes, I did not get the dry cleaning. But to be fair, it's your fault. Right? Repeating yourself without paying attention to what the other person is saying. Whining. It's not fair. Or just repeating yourself. Is there anything more frustrating than feeling that you're not being heard? That you're not entitled to your opinion? That you're not entitled to your feelings? Because the other person is just defensive and defensive. They've gone on the offense and tried to turn it on you. The Rambam talks about what are the ingredients of tshuva. We all know them. And they include confession. I have to acknowledge I did something wrong. If I, yes, but, I did something wrong, but not as bad as what you usually do. That's not tshuva. That's not going to reconcile. That's not going to heal the relationship. And the fourth and final, we'll end with this for tonight, the first part. The fourth and final of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, that if it's present in your marriage, you're in trouble. is what Gottman calls stonewalling. Withdrawing from the relationship is a way to avoid conflict. I put both pictures just to be fair, but we all know which gender does this more than the other. Partners may think they are trying to be neutral, but stonewalling conveys disapproval, icy distance, separation, disconnection, smugness, right? Can I make you feel any less than by turning my body and you're talking, I won't even acknowledge that you are on the same planet as me. I won't even acknowledge your right to exist, let alone what you're saying. Stonewalling. I might as well have put headphones in. I might as well have disconnected. I might as well be in a coma. Because I will not give you the satisfaction of acknowledging your existence, let alone what you're saying. And that can be done with body language. It can be done with stony silence, right? Talking for half an hour about how you feel, and then you haven't said, don't you feel anything? You haven't said a word. Do you have nothing to say?
I heard.
Monosyllabic mutterings, changing the subject, storming out of the room or out of the house, or turning your chair around, or putting on headphones, or the silent treatment. Stonewalling. You cannot have reconciliation, you cannot have a healthy relationship if there is stonewalling, which is taking place. I'll just tell you this last thing, and then we'll wrap it up for tonight. You know, Gottman showed us also, in his research, one of the things he did, it's incredible. He attached all kinds of physiological monitors on the couple while he was counseling them, or at times while he was just observing them. So it's measuring your sweat glands and your blood pressure and your endorphins and adrenaline and whatever else you can measure. And you watch this, it's unbelievable to watch the video afterwards. So you're watching a couple having a fight. And the wife is railing against the husband. She is lacing into him. She's going at him. And if you watch the monitor, it's even. Her voice is raised, her fingers pointing, she's going crazy, she's unloading everything. She's even keel. Inside, physiologically, anatomically, she's calm, cool, and collect. He is partially turned around, looking down, stonewalling. Every single measure of stonewalling. But then you look at the measures, and they're off the charts. Off the charts! He's about to go into cardiac arrest. He might die while stonewalling his wife, sitting there in that chair. Absolutely off the charts. Sweat's pouring off him like he just finished a marathon. His heart is beating at unprecedented rates. He looks like he's about to drop dead. And now if you took a picture, you'd say she's the one who's off the charts and he's calm, cool, and collect. He's just listening, taking it in, doesn't have anything to add. But he's off the charts and she's going crazy. So Gottman says, at moments like that, and I think this is a very, very helpful tip in parenting also, particularly with teenage children. At that moment, you call off the session. Why? Because there's zero hope of progress. Because at the moment that all those indicators show that he's off the charts, at that moment, he is a completely irrational, animalistic, flight or fight person. There's nothing rational in him. He is incapable, I'm picking on him, it could be a her, that individual is incapable of a conversation. So he introduces Gottman the concept of self-soothing. The ability to bring yourself back to the baseline. The ability to bring yourself back to a state of calm, that you could then continue the conversation. So what usually happens though, is that he's stonewalling with his physical features going off the charts, and she just, every second he doesn't answer or make eye contact or even look in her direction, she just takes it up a decibel level. She just kicks it up another level, a notch. But all he's doing is shutting down further and further and further. I said, don't you have anything to say? Don't you have any feelings? You never say anything. You get that from your father. He never said anything. That's why your parents have the worst marriage. He is going deeper into his cave. He is about to have an aneurysm. There is no possible hope of a meaningful conversation that will reconcile anything. At that moment, there needs to be a timeout and self-soothing. As I said, I have found that's helpful, of course, with my neighbor's kids, not my own, but with teenagers. Because I find as a parent, sometimes you're giving some feedback to a child, and the child gets rageful. There's rage. They get angrier. They're reacting very strongly. And the stronger they react, the more you react. And then the roof's about to blow off the top of your house, like a Category 5 hurricane hit. You've taken away all the electronics. You've grounded them through college. And the roof is off. Rather than recognizing earlier in the process that something has happened that has made them incapable of continuing this conversation. Nothing productive will occur. Nothing rational will take place. Nothing is seeping in. They can't communicate. You need to have a break. Send them to their corner. Self-soothe. Calm down. And when you're in a state of calm, we can continue the conversation. A very, very important insight that Gottman has. So again, the four horsemen of the apocalypse with their antidotes are criticism, which is personal, ad hominem, not about the issue and not about how you make me feel, but rather I'm attributing all kinds of attitudes and all kinds of motives to you. And the antidote to that is to complain without blame. I'm not blaming you. I'm not ascribing motive to you. I'm not calling you a name. I'm not threatening to divorce you. I just need my dry cleaning. I just need my dry cleaning. So let's talk about how we can create a better system so I can get my dry cleaning. Number two, defensiveness. Right? Or you put up the wall. Yes, but. Or you go on the offense. I forgot the dry cleaning? You never picked up a bulb in the last 10 years. The antidote to that is to take responsibility. You know something? You're right. I didn't forget the dry cleaning to make you feel bad. But you're right. I did not organize my day in such a way that I could have gotten the dry cleaning. And it is important to you. So I'm going to figure out how to do that. You understand? If you answer that way, the conversation's over in 5 minutes and you can enjoy your evening. Versus the fight and the storm and the fireworks and the 3 days and who will make the first move and who will text. We really should talk about this. You could save a lot of energy. There's a lot of stress in life. There's a lot of stress we can't control. Why have to absorb the stress that we can? Number three was the contempt, a snarl, a snarkiness, sarcasm, humor, calling a name, pressing the button where we know they're most vulnerable. And the answer to that is to build a culture of appreciation. That even when you, for whatever reason, are not in your best space, you will not take it out by making the other feel they are less. There's no hierarchy in your marriage. I married up. You're the greater one. And I'm just so lucky that you are willing to live with me. If that's a feeling in a marriage, there are lots of problems. And lastly, the stonewalling, the answer is physiological self-soothing. If you're tempted to stonewall, I gotta run out of this room because I'm gonna explode and die all over if I don't get out of here. Self-soothing. And the other spouse needs to recognize they need to self-soothe. I'm not going to chase them out of the... When the one runs out of the room or needs a break, I'm not going to chase out flinging even more. Let me pile on! I recognize you need to make a break, and that's okay. When is a time and a place that we're going to continue this conversation? When we're both calm, because we need to resolve this. What we'll start with next week, next Tuesday night, is what Gottman calls the sound relationship house. We're going to begin with the ground floor, the love maps. He's got great love maps. I'll just give you. These are love maps. You're going to have the best dates of your life. I took his love maps. I went out with Yechel on a date. We had the best time. When you were dating, these were the things that you talked about. Now when you date, you know what you talk about? The driving and the tuition, and the homework, and what they got on the math test, and when are your parents coming, and what do they think, we're having them every meal again, and that's what you talk about. You don't talk anymore about, what is my fondest unrealized dream? What is one of my greatest fears or disaster scenarios? What makes me feel most complete? What's my favorite color? What's my favorite way to spend the evening? Can we still answer those questions about our spouse? Do we still know those things about our loved one? Can we get back to dating? And not just talking as if we are a business that has an agenda to cover on the date. We're paying for a babysitter so we can get through our agenda at the restaurant. No, we have to go on dates, and that's done through love maps. So love maps is the ground floor of the house, then fondness and admiration, turning towards instead of against, a positive perspective, conflict management, and we'll get all the way up through the house. So thank you for coming tonight. We will continue, please God, next week.